I want to thank Michael for the warm introduction, for his friendship, for his perseverance, and for paying attention to every detail in arranging my visit. So I really thank you for all of that. And it's true, we've been talking for many years. When I heard what a beautiful evening, how great the weather would be today was, I said, I have to come. I haven't slushed through snow in so long, but just to echo the sentiment that so many others said, it is really astounding on a day like today and with the weather outside to see a full room. It's a testament to the Stanford community, the Stanford Chevra Kadisha, and to that incredible sense of unity, the diversity that's represented in this room. And a night like tonight, too close, too far, fading back. And a night like tonight, there's nothing that gives the Almighty greater joy than to look down and see a community that comes together, diverse parts united and unified in their commitment to the Chesed Shel Emes, to the responsibility to care for those who can't pay back that kindness. I'm a member of our Chevra in Boca Raton. I know that a Tahara never comes. Do I even need this? Can you hear me without the mic?
Yes.
Let's go without the mic. Tahara's never scheduled at a convenient time, almost by definition. And yet, the members of the Chevra, who are so devoted and selfless, deserve not one day on the calendar, but even more. And not only the members of the Chevra, I want to recognize the spouses and the family of the members of the Chevra, who are left picking up whatever was happening in the middle when that phone call came and the schedule of the Tahara. They're part of a team that selfless may not come to the Tahara room, but spouses and family are also very, very much part of what tonight is all about. I want to recognize my colleagues. It was wonderful to hear from the rabbis. I don't know why I had to come from Florida. You have incredible local talent who offered such amazing insights. In particular, my dear friend, Rabbi Cohn, who's not only been a friend, though I look significantly older, he's older and he's been a mentor to me in the rabbinate, got me involved in the RCA, and then he swiftly exited to write a book and go on a speaking tour, and I've remained stuck in that position, but we'll follow. You can hear. Okay, we'll go back to a mic. Try the other mic.
Okay.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't have the privilege of knowing Penny Block, but I do know that communities and Chevra Kadishas are made up of special people. They're not anonymous, they're not generic, they have names, they have faces. They're the ones who show up, they're the ones who leave their indelible impression, not only on the team they worked with, but on a community. And hearing the range of speakers and the tribute that was offered, it's very clear what an incredibly special person she was and what a loss it is for this community. And I hope our words tonight will be in her memory. As was mentioned, Zayin Adar today on the Jewish calendar, and we have two Adars, two Zayin Adars. The Ramah says for Ashkenazic Jewry, the first Adar is the more appropriate to honor Yeretzayit. Sfaradim, the Mechaber, followed the second. Mishneh Berurah says both. So tonight is really, today was an appropriate day to recognize Zayin Adar, the Yeretzayit of Moshe Rabbeinu. Pasuk describes, Vayomer Aleihem ben Me'ah Ve'Asrim Shana Anochi Hayom Lo'uchal Od Latzeis V'Lavo. Moshe says, I'm 120 years old today. I can't keep going out and coming in. Hashem Amar Elai Lo Savori Saradin Azeh. God has said, I've reached the end of the road. It's the end of Moshe's journey. And Rashi quotes the Gemara in Sota Hayom Malu Yamai Ushnasai. Moshe had the awareness. Moshe understood he had reached the fulfillment, the completion of his days, of his years. When one passes away on their birthday, the circuit is complete. And the statement is made that Moshe had realized his potential. He had cemented his place in perpetuity as our paradigmatic leader. Until today, we call him Moshe Rabbeinu. That wasn't his name as a little child. He wasn't called to the dinner table, Moshe Rabbeinu, come for dinner. Moshe Rabbeinu, did you do your homework? But yet we universally, all over and forever, call him Moshe Rabbeinu. He remains our teacher. We have this day to commemorate his Yuritzite, but equally or more importantly, to commemorate and to reflect on his impact, on his influence, on the lessons that he taught us. In fact, one of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith is to know with certainty that Moshe was categorically different than all the people who came before him and all who will come after. The Av HaNeviim, he is the father of prophets. different than everyone else. So what is that lesson? What are we commemorating today? What is the message that he gave us? And Michael chose the topic for tonight about being selfless in a selfie generation, in the selfie era. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe's life has so much to say and to teach us how we can overcome the urges, the temptations that have captured the minds and have distracted so many in our generation. Oxford Dictionary, most prestigious, among the most prestigious dictionaries, a couple of years ago, released its Word of the Year. And the Word of the Year they chose maybe best describes the ethos, the culture of our time was selfie. Most of us in this room did not grow up using or knowing what that word meant. Certainly we didn't take a old camera with film and point it at ourselves. That wasn't our obsession. We didn't pose with our dessert, and we didn't pose at the red light or with the delayed flight. And we certainly didn't pose, as people do today, believe it or not, next to a grave or visiting Auschwitz or all kinds of other places where any sense of appropriateness has been lost. And Oxford Dictionary chose as the word of the year because it most reflected an attitude not only of that year, but since then many years, an attitude of a selfie, a picture we take of ourselves and we share instantaneously. We share, we promote, we post, we try to garner attention. We want people to see where we are and what we're doing. And in the best of circumstances, we're just trying to connect. But unfortunately, too many are not only connecting, they're using it to promote. Look at me, how wonderful my life is. Look at the person I ran into, how important therefore I must be. Look at where I'm eating or what I'm doing or how I'm dressed or what I'm experiencing or who I'm with. This was a mentality, this is an attitude that our ancestors and until recently, none of us ever had. We would never, in a million years, think about calling our entire Rolodex of friends and telling them, can I drop off a picture of me and my dessert? Right? We all joke, we'd torture people to look through our vacation pictures. Maybe. Maybe. But the idea that we monopolize or that we hold hostage our friends and kind of, at least virtually, share in real time this notion of a selfie. And the trend is reflective of an attitude. Of an attitude not only of being a selfie, but being selfish. And I'm not rendering a judgment on everyone who takes a selfie. I've learned, my kids have taught me which button and how to hold it and at what angle. Sometimes you do want to capture a moment, not because you're trying to promote, but because you want to memorialize the special experience of where you're at and what you're doing. Not even necessarily to share with others, but to capture for yourself. And so I'm not rendering a judgment on everyone who's ever taken a selfie. But I am calling on all of us to pause and always ask ourselves, where's our mindset and what are we thinking and why are we doing and what does this attitude lead to? It's reminiscent of the old joke, you know, the person says to the other person, enough about me. What about you? Tell me, what do you think about me? The selfie is, what do you think? Are you going to like, are you going to share, are you going to follow? It's not a coincidence that in recent years we've seen an enormous, enormous explosion, a shocking explosion of teens in this country who are struggling with depression and anxiety, who are struggling with mental health issues, a surge, an enormous rise, suicidal ideation and more. And these are clinical issues. They need treatment. Some of it's chemical. No one, God forbid, is to blame. But I will tell you that a recent paper published in the Clinical Psychological Science correlates the increase in mental health issues among young people with the rise of smartphones, social media, and the mentality of selfie. It's really counterintuitive. You'd think the more I'm living my life for myself, the more cameras on me, the more the spotlight's on me, the more I'm asking you to look at me, the happier I'll be. I'm the center of attention. I have center stage. And yet, all the research is showing the exact opposite. The more that we live lives centered on ourselves, the unhappier we are, the more anxious we are, the more sad, the more depressed we feel. It's an epidemic. It's a challenge not just among young people, but it's affecting us. What's the antidote? What's the response? The answer comes from Moshe Rabbeinu. on his yahrzeit, motze his yahrzeit, the dinner honoring his yahrzeit, we can learn so much. When Moshe delivers his final monologue to the Jewish people in the book of Dvarim, the fifth book of the Torah, and he recounts and reviews the seminal moments the Jewish people had been through, of course, he speaks about the most monumental moment in all of human history. The moment of revelation when God spoke directly to mankind. And Moshe introduces it, though, by telling us, remember my children, remember my people, that in that moment of great revelation, the lights and sounds, the lightning, remember that you recoiled. You weren't able to absorb God's direct words. And listen to what Moshe says. Anochi omeid ben Hashem ubeinechem ba'isahi. Lagid bachem es dvar Hashem. I stood between you and God. I was the intermediary. I was God's mouthpiece. Because you couldn't tolerate hearing directly from God. It was too intense an experience. So Anochi omeid, I stood between the two of you. I transmitted the message for God. But the Baal Shem Tov, HaKadosh, tells us to homiletically read the pasuk very differently. And I think in the Baal Shem Tov suggestion is such a critical message for our generation, not only for the young people, but for all of us. Said the Baal Shem to read it, not Anochi Omeid, that Moshe says, I was the intermediary standing between you and God. But says the Baal Shem Tov, you know what Moshe was telling the Jewish people? Do you know what stands between you and God? Do you know why you struggle with faith? Do you know why it's hard to live a virtuous, meritorious life? Do you know why it's hard to do the right thing? Why your relationships suffer? And why you're filled with envy and jealousy? And why you're quick to anger? Do you know why you're so anxious and worried? Do you know the root of all these challenges? Do you know what's standing between you and God? Anochi, your sense of I, your sense of self, your obsession with taking a selfie, literally and figuratively in life. You know what's omeid bein Hashem ubeinechem? Anochi, the attitude of look at me and listen to me. I need likes and follows. I need the spotlight and the stage. I need to be promoted. That attitude that the world revolves around me, my happiness, my pleasure, what I want. Everyone's got to fall in line with the way I anticipate, when I predict how I'm choreographing and orchestrating the world. And when it doesn't, when I have Anochi that's informing and inspiring my entire perspective of life, what I want, what I need, what I think should happen, but my spouse or my children had a different idea and different thoughts and different plans. Well, when it's Anochi, then it's Omeid. When I had certain plans for how smooth this trip would go and the weather didn't cooperate or the airlines don't cooperate, when it's Anochi, everything has to happen exactly the way that I planned it. When it doesn't, I unravel. I can't handle it. When it doesn't, I lose myself. Because I'm too obsessed and absorbed with myself. Essentially, there's two Anochis that are competing in our lives. And every day, in every moment of every day, in every decision we make, in every conversation we have, in every moment we spend, in every resource we expend, we have to ask ourselves, which of the Anochis are we committed to? Rav Sadia Gaon says there are 613 commandments. Tradition we have at the end of Meseches Makos, that they're Tayag Mitzvos. 613. But says Rav Sadia Gaon, you know the 613? They can all be reduced. They all fall under the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, the Atheritas. The Ten Commandments are really 10 categories. All 613 are subsumed under the 10. But the Ten Commandments, Rav Sadia Gaon goes even further and says, the Ten Commandments can really, they can all be summarized. They're all subsumed under the opening commandment. And you know what? Even the opening commandment, it can all be captured in the opening word. Says Rav Sadia, the totality of Torah, of our Jewish life and living, is all expressed in one word. Anochi. God says, I'm the creator of the universe. I built this world and everyone and everything in it. I did it for you. I want you to get the most benefit. I want you to enjoy. I want you to live the most enriched, empowered life. But make no mistake, I created the world. I programmed it. I know everything about it. And the world is to have a relationship with me. It's to repair it. And it's to build it and be my partner in my image, according to my blueprint. So we can live our lives at every moment with a commitment to Anochi, to God, to feeling the presence of the Almighty, His loving hand on our shoulder, His embrace, to talk to Him like Penny did, as a confidant, as a friend, to lean on Him, to trust in Him, even to protest Him and to object when someone we love is suffering. When we're going through a hard time, it's a great expression of faith to say, God, I protest, I object. This person deserves better. I deserve more. I'll never forget a funeral I did for a woman I had never met. She was a Holocaust survivor. When I met with the family to prepare for the funeral, I asked, what was her relationship with God like? Did she have faith?
She was a visible woman.
And the family said something that changed my entire understanding of Emunah. Changed my rabbinate and how I try to counsel others, but it changed my own life. Family said, you know, she was not an observant woman. Technically, she was not observant. But she had incredible faith. So I said, well, what did that mean? Did she speak to God? Did she pray to God? They said, no. She was furious with God. She never forgave God. She was constantly angry at God still for what she endured in her life. I said, well, I don't understand. You said she was a woman of great faith. And her children explained to me, don't you get it? Don't you get it? Someone's not angry at something they don't believe in. Someone doesn't get angry at someone they didn't expect more from. It's not devastating to you when a stranger on the street didn't stop and intervene to help you. But if it's your parents, whom you turned to and leaned on and expected from, you feel failed you, whether true or not, but from your perspective, then you're devastated. Her being devastated, her being angry her whole life, was actually an expression of her unwavering, unequivocal faith. You're not angry at a figment of your imagination. You're not angry at what you believe. And that's why I think, and I think we have a precedent for it in our Torah. Avraham Avinu, our great patriarch, protests. There's no clock here. I have a watch here. Okay. My flight's not till tomorrow morning, so I have to go. But Avraham Avinu says to God, how could you do that to stone if there's 10 righteous people? How could you? Avraham sets a precedent for us. When you see what you feel is an injustice, God invites us to protest. Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe says, God, show me your face. I want to understand, why do bad things happen to good people? And God says, you can only see the back of my head, you can't see my face. You can only understand things in retrospect. After the fact, maybe if you're lucky, you could put the pieces of the puzzle together. Maybe if you're lucky, you can turn the tapestry around so all those little threads, you can see the little bit of the shape. After the fact, if you're lucky. But Avraham, Moshe, and others are present for us to protest. So we live our lives with a commitment either to His Anochi or to our Anochi. Is it about Him or is it about us? Is it a life of meaning and purpose, a life of virtue, a life of making a difference, of leaving a legacy? Or is it a life of indulging our pleasures, our happiness, our ego, our self? What we want, what we need, how we think the world should function. Those are the two choices. The two anochis are competing from the moment we wake up in the morning to the moment we fall asleep. There are all kinds of temptations and distractions that are encouraging us to indulge and invest in our anochi. Just do it. Obey your thirst. Be happy. Do what you want. But our sacred Torah has created a platform of living that creates a mindfulness and a meaningfulness to say, no, I'm not going to succumb. I'm not going to indulge my animal instinct, my animal impulse. I'm not going to feed the anochi of my selfies. My nafesh bahami, my animal self. I have a God inside me. The anochi of God is not only believing in God, it's believing in ourselves, in our capacity, in who we could be, in the potential that we have. says to believe in God, the commandment, to believe God, that whole Torah being reduced from 613 to 10, 10 to 1, 1 to the opening word, included in that commandment to believe God is to believe in ourselves, because every one of us is a unique and distinct expression of God in this world. Irreplaceable. Of the billions who came before, of the billions who may come after, nobody is like us. The world was created just for us. The world and everything in it, we have that much to offer. Our talents, our skills, our backgrounds, our position, even our liabilities and our challenges, position us uniquely to make a difference in this world. It's how we end the first statement we say every single morning when we wake up. Modeh ani lefanecha. I'm so grateful to you, God. I wake up with an attitude of gratitude. But I end that statement. Many people put the comma in the wrong place. It's not it's bechamah, God, with your kindness. I woke up this morning. Rabbah, great, and then your faith. Who can talk about God having faith? We're the ones who have faith in God. In whom does God have faith? Rabbah, we say it every morning. First thing we wake up in the morning, we teach our children from the age they can speak. Modeh ani, I won't sing it for you, I will spare you. But Rabbah, God, the answer is, if I woke up today, if I'm alive, if there's a pulse, if there's air in my lungs, then you have faith in me, God, that I have yet more to accomplish and to contribute and to shape and mold this world. You've invited me for yet one more day to be your partner to make a difference. To serve you, Anochi. Not a life of service that's a sacrifice. That's not our religion. Our religion is not a sad religion to make sacrifices and sacrifices. It's not the Anochi, a commitment to God that you have to give up for him. What he asks us to do for him is really to live the very best lives for ourselves. But what's at the center of our circle? What's at the center of our lives? Is it us or is it him? Are we living lives of selfies or of selfless? Rav Elimelech of Lezhinsk, your side is coming up, says, if you look when the Aseres HaDibros and the Ten Commandments are given, don't start with Anochi. He suggests you look at the pasuk, the verse earlier, Vaydaber Elokim es kol advarim ha'ilu le'mor, Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher otzeisicha. God spoke as kol hadvarim ha'ilu le'mor. God spoke all these things saying. And then we begin the Ten Commandments. So normally we read it, there was an introductory phrase, God spoke all these things, and then we get to the meat and potatoes. Then we get to the Ten Commandments. But the Rebbe Rabbi Elimelech said no. The way to read it is, Vaydaber Elokim es kol advarim ha'ilu le'mor. As kol hadvarim ha'ela, all these things. The clothing we're wearing, the food we ate, the car we drove to get here, our home, the incredible gift of the technology that we live with in our time, our health, our well-being, our family, our livelihood. Kol hadvarim ha'ela, all of these things are lemor anochi. They're all saying one thing. I'm God, I'm here. I'm here, and I'm inviting you to have a relationship with me. I want you to connect with me, to lean on me, and even to protest to me. I want you to feel my presence, and I want to feel yours. The difference of which Anochi we're serving, the Anochi of God or the Anochi of ourselves, which is our obsession? Making God proud or indulging our own happiness? That difference is not a gift you're giving God, though certainly it gives nachas ruach, certainly it gives incredible pride and joy to the Almighty. But that's not why we're doing it. Putting his Anochi ahead of ours, not allowing our Anochi to be omeid, to stand between us and God, is the biggest game changer in your life. By far. You want to not get anxious? Then realize everything's for a plan, and everything's for a reason. As I sat in the back of the Uber, slipping and sliding on the way to Stamford, Connecticut, and worried, late am I going to miss the program? Will I end up upside down? What's going to be? I have to catch myself all the time. I give an amishi in my community, and every week we learn a different text, but essentially it's the same lesson. And it's basically a self-help, it's basically a support group on MMM. And it's for me.
I do it for me because I end up forgetting in between one month and the next.
The very lessons I'm teaching, it's very hard to live by. So I invite others to come with us.
But it's so easy to forget.
But when you take that deep breath, you realize it's MMM. You know, I'm not in control. My driver's doing the best. He did great.
Gave me 5 stars. Deserves
all those stars and more. You don't get anxious and you're not worried. And you don't say what will be. And you don't try to control things that are outside of your control. Because emunah is the greatest elixir. It's the greatest drug. It's the greatest calming agent. And when you fly off the handle and you get angry because this one didn't behave the way I wanted and the way I programmed, this one didn't do what I expected, then you look for the moon and you realize everything's for a reason. I can only control myself and I can control how I react to others. I can't control them. So why would I ever be angry? And when the feeling of envy or jealousy rises inside me and I say, you know, I wish I had that car, that jewelry, that home, that job, that spouse, those children. You stop yourself and you say, Anochi. I have what I need. I have what was meant for me. I have what God, my loving Father in heaven, thinks is the best thing for me. So why ever be jealous or angry? The difference of which Anochi we're serving is the difference between meaning and emptiness, between happiness and disappointment, serenity and anger, contentment and jealousy. The source of almost every argument we have. Think about it over the next few days. God forbid you'll have no arguments. If you do, pause and think about it. The source of almost every argument and every complaint that we offer is Anochi Omeid, Bein Hashem Ubeini. It's because my Anochi, my ego, my sense of self, my obsession with taking literal and figurative selfies in life is what started that fight or escalated it or made me stand on ceremony and not end it when I know I should. It's what caused me to complain. Is what caused my frustration. So what's the antidote? What's the response? How do we transition from a life of selfie to selfless? From our Anochi, which ends up standing between us and God and us and people around us, or the Anochi of a dedicated life of selflessness and of virtue and of meaning and of purpose? It's all about, are we a giver or a taker? We say a verse. We're still reading the Torah portions of the Exodus. The miracle of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that God found that we had the merit to redeem us and take us out. Why? We were on the lowest level, 49th level, saturated, marinated, contaminated with impurity and moral depravity and corruption. And yet God said, this people, they're my people, I got to take them out. With what merit? Why? The Chafetz Chaim has an incredible insight. If we seek redemption in our lives, from health challenges, and livelihood challenges, and relationship challenges, and loneliness challenges, and fertility, if we're seeking comfort, what was the source of our redemption from Egypt remains the secret and the formula of our redemption today. We say in our davening, Nachisa b'chastecha, Nihalta b'aznecha al-medei kachecha, Nachisa b'chastecha, naz yashir. We say it every day in our davening, Parshas B'shalach, a few weeks ago. What do those words mean? Nachisa b'chastecha. B'chastecha, we understand, is chesed. The Ibn Ezra says it's in the past tense, but it's really a literary tool. Sometimes the Torah will use something in the past tense. It's describing something has not yet happened. It's in the future. It's prophetic. Moshe is saying it's about God. Nachisa b'chastecha. God, you're going to be so kind to us. Protect us with pillars of fire, clouds of glory. The Rashbam says God's kindness was that he's going to escort us to Eretz Yisrael, nefesh b'nefesh, you're going to take us, you're going to make it smooth and easy. Take us all in Aliyah, nachisa b'chastecha, you're taking us to the promised land. The Sforno says the chastecha is the kindness, is a reference back to Yetzias Mitzrayim, when God guided the Jewish people out. The Ramban gives an answer, there's many, many answers, but the Chafetz Chaim says the following. He says, you took us out with chesed, nachisa b'chastecha. God, we acknowledge and praise you. You took us out with chesed. Which chesed? Who's chesed? There's a Medrash Tana de Be'el Yo that says that when the Jewish people were still in Egypt, they made a commitment to one another, that they were going to show kindness to one another. They made a commitment that no matter how harsh the world was out there, no matter how mistreated, no matter how oppressed, no matter how targeted and persecuted, no matter how many anti-Semitic tweets, that they were going to show kindness to one another, and that at least internally within the community, within the family, we wouldn't aggravate one another. We wouldn't be hostile to one another. We wouldn't be adversaries with one another. But they made a covenant among themselves on the lowest level of tumah, contaminated with the impurity and the corruption and the immorality of the Egyptians, but yet the wherewithal and the resiliency to commit to be kind to one another. When they realized the world's not going to be kind to us, let's at least be nice to one another. I think we're waking up to that reality again. We had a 75-year reprieve. Thousands of years of anti-Semitism, persecution, and we were teased for the last 75 years when the world, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, gave the Jewish people a reprieve. And we're seeing this resurgence not only in Europe, elected officials in our own country, unimaginable anti-Semitic tropes. Such a ridiculous thing we call it a trope, because then we say they should apologize for the trope. They should apologize for being anti-Semites. We don't reject the trope, we reject the anti-Semite. We're seeing that hatred again. So even in Egypt, when they understood the world is harsh, and the world can oppress and it can persecute us, so at least let's be nice to one another. Don't you ever feel like that with the Jewish people? It's a harsh world, it's a harsh reality. You know, sometimes you come home from a hard day at work or a hard day slipping and sliding in the snow, and you come home and someone already like unloads on you about something they need you to do or you didn't do right, or and you're like, this is my, can't I just find a place of refuge, of safety, of comfort, or of peace? So that's what they felt, the Jewish people in Egypt. Let's at least be nice to one another. They made this covenant. And the Chafetz Chaim says, Nachisa b'chastacha, you know why we were redeemed? The catalyst of the redemption was kindness, but it wasn't God's kindness for us. It was our kindness for one another. Because when a person is persecuted and oppressed, when a person is hated, when a person spends their day building bricks and pyramids, breaking their back, and when they come home, they say, you know, it's not about me, a selfie, looking in the mirror, my happiness, my pleasure, but Nachisa b'chastacha, what can I do for you? How can I make your life better? How can I relieve your pain, your suffering? How can I uplift you? That is the source, the catalyst of redemption. It's extraordinary that no matter what's going on in our lives, we can see and we can think about and we can care about others. And the Chafetz Chaim says, that's the pasuk in Yirmiyahu. We know the song, the High Holidays, Komar Hashem, Zacharti la chesed ne'urayach. The chesed ne'urayach, the chesed of our youth, the loving kindness of our youth, is not the God's kindness of us. God says, I remember when you were young, when you had nothing, and yet you were so nice to one another. You were so selfless. You cared so much about others. We say in our Tehillim, Hashem Shomrecha, Hashem Tzilcha, Yad Yiminecha. God is likened to a shadow. Why is God compared to a shadow? So the Chafetz Chaim says, because what does a shadow do? It imitates exactly what you do. Shadow doesn't get a mind of its own. The shadow doesn't do its own thing. The shadow follows exactly what you just did. God is our shadow. When we're nice to one another, we're patient and kind and sensitive and understanding and selfless, when we're givers, not takers, then God is forgiving and kind and sensitive and loving and uplifting for us. And when we're harsh and exacting and aggravating and carry a grudge and escalate a fight, then God does that exact same thing to us. He is our shadow, Hashem Tzilcha. So my friends, that's my message for tonight. The message is how to be selfless in an age of a selfie is to be a student of Moshe Rabbeinu, to follow in his footsteps on his yahrzeit. Vayigdal, Moshe grows up, and he could have hid in the palace. He was safe and secure, insulated and protected from the elements. But Vayigdal, he goes up. Vayetzei Elachav, he goes after his brothers. Because Moshe, to be a student of Moshe, is not to be satisfied. I have everything. I'm healthy, I'm happy, I have a paycheck, I'm good.
I'm good.
Moshe is good. But he said, as long as my fellow Jew is not good, I'm not good. If you're hurting, I'm hurting. If you're in pain, I'm in pain. If you're suffering, I'm suffering. I don't hide behind the cocoon, the insulation of the palace. Vayetzei Elachav, he went out, liros b'siv lo sam, to look for and to seek and to understand. We were talking recently about the phenomenon
of too many singles to send shots and the alone, and end up all week wondering, will I get invited, will I not get invited, do I make plans, do I cook, do I buy flights, do I not, will I get a pity, as someone's walking out, do you have a place, if not, I guess, you can come with me. To keep people in our mind, in the forefront of our thoughts, a little gesture, and in the dignity of an invitation in advance, to be thoughtful.
Someone help
show them their driveway, their walkway, they live alone, they're unable to do it, how do they get out in the morning?
That gesture of thoughtfulness.
What that means and what that does, it brings redemption to the world. But here's the thing. When you offer that gesture, not just the text message or the invitation, but actually follow through on nachis b'chastach, an act of kindness. Do you know who the greatest beneficiary of is? You know who grows the most? You do. We do. Study after study after study shows. I'm a rabbi, I'm not a psychologist, but I do know how to Google. And study after study after study shows. They're treating people with clinical depression today by encouraging them to volunteer. All kinds of antidepressants and all kinds of therapies that are incredibly important, and of course we endorse and support when appropriate and necessary, but often they come up short. And study after study is showing that even when they come up short, you know what's effective? Volunteering. Getting outside of one's own skin and comfort zone. And pointing the camera not at ourselves, but pointing it away. Realizing our potential, why we're here, who we're meant to be, exchanging our anochi, our obsession with ourself, which stands between us and others, and stands between ourselves and our own happiness, and replacing it with the anochi of God. Of a world of molding and shaping and partnering with him. I'll tell you something incredible. There was a Harvard study, and they asked children, what do your parents care more about? Achievement and happiness, or if you're kind to others? Do they care more about your grades and if you're happy? Did you get the lunch you wanted? Do you have the latest iPhone? Do you have the latest Xbox? Are you getting good grades and you're happiness? Or are you kind to others? And you know what the Harvard study showed? 80% of the children polled that my parents care more about my grades and my happiness than my others. And the researchers, I don't think this is typical in research, at the conclusion, offered a suggestion of what we need to do. So I guess a homework assignment for your children, your grandchildren, your neighbor's children, your nephews and your nieces. When children come home from school, not to ask, how'd you do on your test today? How are your grades today? Were you happy with the lunch I packed you today? Can I come pick you up because it's snowing, it's raining, I want you to be so happy and protected and never have to... Instead, well, you can do all of that later in the evening, but for children to come home and know they will be asked, did you do something kind for someone else today? The researchers concluded that's how we'll move the needle. Will change that result within our children, their impression of what's important to us. If instead of asking only or first about your grades, how well did you do? How did you do in the class? How did everyone else do? Was there a curve? Are you happy? But to ask, did you do something kind? You know what a child's whole day is different when they know they're going to have to answer that question at the dinner table. They're going to have to compete with their siblings with their answer to that question at the dinner table. They're going to seek out opportunities to help other people. Winston Churchill said, we make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. And the last thing we want to be remembered for is making a living, but never having made a life. Of taking selfies, but never being selfless. This group, the Chevra Kadisha, whom we're honoring this evening, and I join in honoring and applauding you, so incredible. Our people who know how to make that difference, our givers, not takers, who show up selflessly, who can say, I did something kind for someone else. And the consequence, incredibly, of giving is that we find our happiness. If you want your child to be happy, don't ask, are you happy and what can I do to make you happy? Ask, what did you do to help someone else today? And that's how they will learn what happiness, genuine, authentic, where true happiness comes from. I'll end by just telling you one more thing, an incredible Rambam. The Rambam in the end of Hilchos Megillah, at the end of the second chapter, the Rambam says, makes an incredible comment. If a person has limited funds, then they can either allocate them to nicer bottles of wine, single malt scotch at their Purim Suda, to a fancier themed shalach manos to compete and impress, to more impressive matching costumes, or they could use the money for matanas davyayim to give to the indigent and poor. What should they do? Now the answer is obvious. You don't need the Rambam to know that the virtuous thing is to give more money to the poor. But the reason the Rambam provides, that's the incredible thing. The Rambam says, don't give the money to others because it'll make them happy. You're happy. They deserve to be happy. Give them money because they'll be happy. You know what the Rambam understood, what research is only discovering today? The Rambam almost 1,000 years ago said, you know why? Because Adar is about happiness. Purim is about happiness. Mishenichnas Adar Ma'arav Simcha. And if Purim and Adar is about our happiness, you know what's going to make you the happiest? Not a bottle of the cave, not the most expensive wine I can find. The single malt scotch comes in its own arm, kush. Not a greater cut, first cut, corn beef, it's not going to be on the jealousy, or more impressively themed shalach manos. Purim and Adar about your happiness, and you know what's going to make you happiest? When you share what you have with others. The reason to allocate and give it is not because they deserve to be happy because you're happy. Forget that. You deserve to be even happier. And how will you be even happier? By taking what you have and giving it. Mishenichnas Adar Ma'adin is simcha. What is the ma'adin? We have more simcha. What could the calendar says? The Jewish calendar, the funeral home says that the first of all Adar the calendar says should be happy. How is it even from yesterday? I'm not happy today. I'm happy because the calendar says. Last night I had a five maximum months. This is incredible insight. The word ma'adin can be quantity or quality based on the Mesha Shachah. So we usually think ma'adin is in quantity. What it is that makes me happy. It's not a nice car, fancier clothing, more expensive jewelry. The matter is, I redefine what is the source of my simcha. A person is living with selfless, not self-righteous, they want to give greater joy. And then I want to judge them into his retirees and any volunteers in the hospital this evening. You know what I want to give greater joy? Volunteering, showing up, giving. I've ever redefined my happiness. And are you happy? This is a bigger bank account, the fancy school, the most expensive home, the nice car. But who helped the last row? He says, no, little child is happy. You give them a spoon and a pot, they make it happy. They get a little older, they get a toy to be happy. A little older, they get a toy with that, they're happy. And a little older, they get a toy that becomes a child to be happy. And a little older, they get a car to be happy. And a little older, so as we grow, the definition of happiness changes physically. And Mishenichnas Adar Ma'arav Simcha means, as we grow spiritually, our definition of happiness should change and grow spiritually. So I bless us all, in his memory, and in merit, the wonderful members of the Chevra Kadisha, and the family who give so much to the community, that we transform ourselves from selfie to selfless, and that we find the happiness that we're always searching for. Thank you so much.